with this theme of art ain't all paint, that's just a come on. And it's a chance, an occasion to talk about all the different kinds of things that art is. Last week a few of you were around here, and I labored over the theme art and truth, and was trying to talk about art as a way of knowing. And I'm trying to build up a case for the artist as not just being someone who knows only about turpentine and how to get paint off cashmere sweaters and off his necktie. I'm trying to suggest that the artist isn't just an entertainer or a clown, someone who gives interesting after-dinner speeches, but that it should be taken very seriously. And we've had all kinds of demonstrations of some art as a very powerful way of knowing and worshiping and experiencing. And what Herb did last night suggests that art ain't all paint. And there were a lot of things that happened in these little short images. And in a way, Herb was being very revolutionary when he's talking about plastic or putty pews and all these kinds of things. I think this might be the general theme of this dimension of the artist. Let's think of him as a revolutionary. And I've talked about this before, about the artist as one who disturbs or jars or alters or irritates. I like to think of the artist as being a bit corrosive. And I think Tweet was talking about that yesterday in the Mad Magazine morality theme. And he was opposed to certain comic strips that just kind of underlined all the nice things that we like to believe in, and he put an emphasis on those kinds of comic strips that really force us to look at things the way they are, and this is sometimes very uncomfortable. We have the image of I'm speaking about painting, and we have the image of the painting that fits over the fireplace by which we wear slippers and smoke a pipe and fall asleep. That's the kind of art that we like to have around. And I'm trying to suggest that some kind of really significant art maybe is the kind that we'd rather lock up in a zoo, like the Walker Art Center or the Minneapolis Art Institute. We don't really like to have it around, except maybe on Sunday when we sort of hold our nose and run through that place as fast as we can so we can say we've been to a museum. But any kind of art, whether it's preaching or singing or writing, acting, the film, all of these various media, there should be this kind of knife edge to it, which I think makes us wish that it were locked up in a zoo, and it doesn't just make us want to fall asleep. Nicholas Berjive talks about art as a kind of revolutionary activity, and he says the origin of the creative impulse is man's yearning for a different kind of world, and this man believes in the possibility of creating some kind of perfect world, and he believes that through man's creative activity, which I call just plain hard work, that it's possible for man to fashion a new and better kind of world. And the Catholic writer Maritain says something a bit different from that. He says man simply celebrates what the Creator has already made, and he doesn't participate in creation, but he simply responds to it. And that's a bit different from what Berjive is saying. But in a sense, I think the two are really the same. Bear Jive is, puts the emphasis on building new worlds, new structures, new ways of acting and thinking. Maybe when Maritain says the artist is only responding to what's there, it has something to do with this theme that maybe we're working to death, man redeeming the world or bringing to life things that are sort of lying out there that are buried. Maybe if we think of the artist as just, in Maritain's sense, as just responding to the creation, what he really is doing is showing us things that we've never seen before. Helping us maybe just to become more at home with our world. And sometimes, maybe what, from the Maritain point of view, this bringing out of the dust things that were always there, maybe this is very disturbing. Maybe we discover things lying around in our world that we'd rather keep buried. So I don't think these two men are, I mean, in a sense, I think these two men are saying the same kind of thing. We talk about art as a mirror, just paintings reflecting the world we see around us. And maybe it is a mirror, but I think it's a mirror that you really see you see beyond, you see through it. And this image that we see in the mirror is Bear Jive's image. It is an image that alters our view of the world or that changes our view of the world. And either we like what we see and we hold it, we hold it in high esteem, or maybe we rebel against it and we try to get rid of it, burn it up, or censor it. But the work of art, I would call a kind of structure of our world. And as we trace the history of art, we are in very subtle ways noticing a change in the structure of our world. Some of you know the names of some artists, but I'm thinking of a man like Monet, who painted the water lily. He's an impressionist painter at the end of the 19th century. And he painted haystacks and flower fields and all of these kinds of things. All he did was maybe start painting with little dabs of color, and he painted light and sort of the energy of light. And I don't think anybody had ever seen the world that way before. And the whole world changed because his experience of the world was maybe more penetrating than anybody else's had been up to that time. And whether we know him or not, he's influenced the way we experience things, the way we feel, the way we see the world. And in subtle ways, his experiments have sifted down into music, into literature, into the way we shape our houses. And it really has had an impact on us. The painter doesn't just paint things that are already there. And I've tried to talk about this at other times. But the writer doesn't write about things that are already there. He doesn't know what he's writing about until he writes it, or he doesn't know what he's painting about until he paints it. And his act of painting is a way of finding out about his world. And as he sits and stares and digs into whatever corner of the world he's looking at, he makes discoveries for himself. And these discoveries then really do have an impact on us. Right now we can't see the forest for the trees, but I suspect that our friends the Beatles have had a profound influence on our lives. And I would suspect that the movie The Yellow Submarine might subtly change the whole shape of movies, and it's there in the magazines, it's in television. And all they were doing was trying to sing better songs. They didn't know what they were doing maybe when they started out, but they've created a whole new way of thinking. And our children are certainly influenced by this. And they're strange people that we can't understand, and we'd like to lock them up in zoos, like Walker Art Centers. I was talking last week about if you can see something, then you've created it. And this is maybe what the Beatles have done. They've heard something, or they felt something, or what Monet did. He saw certain qualities of light that nobody had ever been able to see before, and he brought this into being. And in a way, this is again a reflection of Maritain's idea that the artist is one who responds maybe to something that's already there, but it's something that was hidden. I think it would be safe to say that we get more enjoyment out of nature, like out of a mountain, than we maybe do out of a painting of a mountain. Or maybe we like photographs of mountains, but even there, sometimes they're quite uncomfortable, because the work of art focuses on some quality of the mountain, or some quality of nature or experience. It intensifies the mountain or the landscape or the man. Maybe this focusing and intensification sometimes is quite uncomfortable. We don't really like what we see. We'd rather go back to the mountain and just look at it with our kind of half-blind eyes. There are all kinds of other dimensions. I'm talking about some external objects, but there are feelings we have and experiences we have that we don't like to have them dangling out in front of us. Paul Fanning's major charity is Forest Lawn Cemetery. And he goes around here preaching.
That was below the belt.
No, all day long he goes around preaching about the glories of Forest Lawn Cemetery. And he's... all right.
Okay.
But Forest Lawn is...
humor, I'm sure.
Forest Lawn is dedicated to the idea of repressing the whole notion of death. And it makes it just a beautiful kind of sleep. I haven't been there, but it's a fine piece of real estate, and it's your house there is better than the house you're living in, and you just can't wait to get there. And we could take any of these kinds of human experiences, and maybe we could say that we spend an awful lot of energy somehow repressing these things, or prettying them up, or making them be the way we'd like them to be, or to make them feel good. And we surround ourselves with things that help us fool ourselves. I think that was Tweet's argument yesterday about Little Orphan Annie and some of these people. And that's why he liked Mad Magazine. Because it doesn't let us fool ourselves. It intensifies the focuses on things as they really are. And this is the same as intensifying the experience of the mountain, or Monet's probing light and finding this wonderful spectrum of color and light. Art is a way of just forcing us to look at ourselves, and it helps us to intensify all of these sort of motivations and desires and feelings that we'd like to keep hidden. And it keeps bringing them out, because they are there and they are influencing us, and maybe we need to rehabilitate them, or make them work for us instead of against us. I'm suggesting that the artist really does create our experience. He builds our culture. He shapes our values. He gives form to our religious convictions. And maybe God is the same today, yesterday, and forever. But the shape of God certainly changes. Sometimes he's very bland and very sweet and very pretty. Sometimes he's very stern. Sometimes he's very disturbing, and we can't take that kind of disturbance for very long. And so then we invent songs like Beautiful Savior, where God is a nicer kind of fellow to have around. I like Beautiful Savior, and I get goose pimples every time the St. Olaf Choir finishes a concert with that great song. But I resent it a little bit, because it seems like it is prettifying something that ought to be a bit stronger. This beauty business, and we're supposed to be talking about revolution here, and we'll get back to this theme, but I use the word beautiful savior, and I guess we talk about the artist as primarily concerned with creating something beautiful. But in an art school or around an art studio, you rarely hear the word beauty used. Beauty is just some sort of byproduct. It's not a goal. And I think as far as the artist is concerned, everything is beautiful. There isn't anything ugly. And what he's just trying to do, again, is to bring to life and to sort of redeem or to hold sacred and precious everything, the whole dimension of human experience, love, death, sadness, tragedy, the whole creation. It's garbage, it's rubble, it's nice sunsets, all these things, I think, have some kind of value and some kind of worth. And the artist would consider everything beautiful. Sometimes it's shocking. Delacroix writes in his memoirs about how shocked he was when he realized that at his mother's funeral, he got terribly involved in contemplating the color of her skin, this beautiful green skin. But there is this kind of detachment with which the artist tends to view all things. All things are unique in themselves. They have their own reason for being. They have their own intrinsic merit. Everything is beautiful. But this sort of detached response to his mother's color.
This is a semantic thing, but really, does the artist really believe everything is beautiful, or is the artist willing to respect everything and judge it in his own way and allow others to produce their things and not say everything is beautiful, but that I respect the fact that this is something I like and that really has an impression that in some way moves me. And maybe something else moves you a little bit more than it moves me.
Well, maybe if we leave out the word liking, you don't have to like everything.
I guess when you say beautiful,
doesn't that... It's such a hard word to use. You don't have to like it. When I'm talking about beautiful savior, that's something we all like. I don't think there's anybody who can't be... feel positively towards that kind of a song. But I like the word move.
That we don't like.
I think that's right. That's the way I see it. But again, maybe it's a semantic or a point of view.
Sure, I don't like.
He's running a little bit of a sound barrier.
Yeah.
Could I interrupt you for a moment?
Yes.
I would like to take exception with your statement or with your assertion that beauty is one of the important elements in art. I can count you on the fingers of my hand a whole lot of works which are definitely created to depict horror in its most brusque crossways. Now start with the horrors of war of Goya. Look at the drawings of Daumier, where the peoples are caricatured. Look at Picasso's Guernica. This is the picture against the war, a very powerful picture which brings out the horror of this senseless murdering of the town at its peak. And I got a book right after the Second World War, written by some Jew, which was a memorial to these 6 million people which were murdered and burned by the Nazis. This was illustrated with a whole series of little gas showing nothing but furnaces and smoke coming out of the furnaces, barbed wire around, pictures in complete horror, bones of hands ringing. I mean, absolutely can give you the creeps, but very powerful work of art. And this has nothing to do with you.
All right. Let's see. I should have thought about this word beauty. I shouldn't have brought it up at all.
I thought it was beautiful that you did. because there's something that I can see and hear that I wouldn't have heard or seen otherwise, and I think that's the point. It's not a judgmental word to me. It's not an evaluative word.
Most of us use that word that way, though.
It has the aspect of being open or honest to me.
Actually, we use it as an adjective, and sometimes I think it can be used probably as a noun.
It's the consensus of the beautiful spirits here assembled that you'd be permitted to retract it.
Start over. I said that you don't hear the word used around the studio, and that an artist just doesn't use the word. He doesn't think about beauty. Beauty seems to be something like a cosmetic that you put on the surface of things to make it sort of palatable.
I would go even a little further than that. This old scholastic idea of goodness, beauty, and truth. I don't think artists sit down and think, and now, how am I going to portray goodness, beauty, and truth? It's an entity in itself. It's part of your way of looking at life. You don't dissect it in a studio. And speaking to what you talk about that book, Ben Shahn said that the purpose of his art was to thread protest through the meaning of reality. That's what that book did in its own way. And no, it wasn't beautiful, but it is part of the world. I mean, it was a thing that existed.
Well, all I think except was the beauty. First, we have to define what it is. And we want to get the discussion going there, but I don't like it.
Well, John might appreciate this picture by virtue of the fact that the artist was able to blend things together in such a way that it became a beautiful thing for him. He wasn't looking at the picture as a whole, but at the parts of it.
He was looking at the green skin of his mother.
But you have it. You have it in the Grunewald's Crucifixion, where Christ is with the green skin as a dying, agonized human being. It's extremely powerful, one of the most famous pictures of all time, I would say, the Ismail altar, which was a bone of contention between France and Germany. It was specifically mentioned in the Versailles Treaty that this picture had to be turned from France by the French.
Well, I was using words like arresting or in the negative sense, but I would say, the way beauty is usually used, it means something that is without any tension. It's just pure surface. It's bland. It's kind of pure decoration. There just isn't any kind of. It's not disturbing. A beautiful picture doesn't belong in a zoo, and I'm for what you're talking about. Someplace in the back of my mind, I have a good definition of the word beautiful, and I can't pull it out. But if something has character, or it's honest, or it's expressive, it's full of tension, it's got a life of its own. It arrests you. It grabs you. It demands your attention, then I guess we could call it beautiful.
Which implies then there are some things that are not.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, well,
but
yeah, the thing that is not.
But earlier you were saying the artist thinks all things are beautiful. And that's where I'm confused.
But perhaps he sees the beauty in the tension between the ugly, like. You know.
Well, but his definition of beauty doesn't allow everything to be beautiful. Mm-hmm. The definition of beauty.
Well, I can look at a garbage dump, you know, and see reality. See it right there. You get the smells, you get everything. And I don't really enjoy it. And you probably don't either. But I can look at a picture of the garbage dump and get something out of it. Because it's, well, I don't know, it isn't realistic. It's more idealistic. Because there are things that are not there that in reality are when you're actually at the dump.
You don't get the smell in the picture?
But I can think of some garbage dump paintings that maybe are worse than the real thing. They're just almost impossible to be around. Like,
I think there are things that can really smell.
Well, should we play with this word some more?
Yeah.
Maybe it could, let me bring in another book here. And this has something to do with what we're just talking about. This is, I have a few notes from a book by William Lynch called Christ and Apollo.
Christ and what?
Apollo.
Apollo?
That Greek fellow. And he uses this as a way of talking about art. And this has something to do with this question of the beautiful. But he talks about Christ as the perfect prototype of the artist, or the significant artist. And he defines the definitely human qualities of Christ, and he says, Christ moved down into all the realities of man to get to his Father. The way to wisdom for the artist leads through the finite, not away from it. And he talks about how Christ doesn't go marching off towards beauty or towards the infinite or towards the dream. And that's some of the quality you get in this song, The Beautiful Savior. He compares this Christ who became finite and digs down into all the dimensions of what it means to be a human being and what it means to be involved with the earth. The opposite of this is this Apollo. He calls him a Gnostic dreamer, the knight of the infinite, the man of timeless ideas who rejects the daily bread of experience in his search for meaning. He tries to get as much as possible of heaven out of as little as possible of earth, and even the little earth he does touch is not taken seriously in a cognitive way. And I think there are images of Christ, like if you compared Giorgione's image of Christ with the Grunewald image of Christ, the Giorgione is this beautiful savior who really seems to have nothing to do with the earth, or the finite, or the definite, or the human. It's this sort of dreamlike, timeless figure that exists someplace else. And this Grunewald Christ, he has green skin because perhaps he's a syphilitic Christ. At least he seems to be suffering from some kind of morbid disease. And it's a terrible kind of experience to be around. But in this Lynch book, he talks about how Christ illuminates the creation. He takes a kind of dead, flat creation and brings it to life and makes paths through the creation which lead to the infinite, or which lead to the Father. And it's not by leaving the earth and the human and all of these human dimensions that one reaches the Father, but it's by going through them. And that there was some of that idea expressed this morning in Norman's discussion of Proverbs. So at the risk of working this redemption idea to death, Christ rehabilitates and redeems and reclaims, rediscovers, and illumines man and his experience in the world he lives in. And maybe ultimately the world he lives in would feel quite natural, and man would really feel at home here, and he might really feel at home with himself if everything could be perfect or be the way it ought to be. And I think all the arts are sort of working for Christ in this kind of mission, in this kind of goal. Herb does it when he puts the sign of the cross on the peanut. We did this in a couple of services, a service a couple of weeks ago. There are lots of, we were talking about forest lawns, there are a lot of these things like death that ought to be rehabilitated or reclaimed. There's this whole theme of love, and we've been talking here about how love has turned into something very superficial or something very sentimental, or it becomes a kind of pure lust through the kinds of images that we surround ourselves with in our magazines or our papers. And maybe the artist can play a role in rehabilitating these kinds of human experiences. But let me talk more specifically about revolution just for a few minutes. In a political revolution, we're involved with just change for its own sake. Yes? Well, wait a minute. I have to compare it to an artistic revolution. But you could take the idea expressed in the book The Bread and the Wine, where this revolutionary is cautioning another revolutionary, and he's saying, all you're doing is replacing one tyranny with another. But you could talk about a political revolution as a stream that just flows on. And it's always in change, it's always in a kind of flux. There are artistic revolutions, but if you think of art as something more static, it's a big pool that never gets filled up. It's sort of the end towards which the stream goes. It's a reservoir. And one of the first discussions we had here, I was trying to talk about how art doesn't really change. It's really the same today as it was 40,000 years ago. But the artist affirms, maybe the political revolutionary is really denying things or existing situations. Maybe if we take Maritain's sense of the word creation, the artist is confirming and adding new things to this reservoir. And I don't think there's any old art or new art in a way. There just get to be more of these human experiences that are added to this pond or this reservoir. The dimensions of the world are increased. So in this sense, the artist, I'd like to think of him as a revolutionary, and he's constantly at war with his world, but in another sense, he's very positive and he affirms. He's adding good work to this reservoir. I like to think of the artist in one way as a kind of mortician, and in this sense, he's like the political revolutionary. He's a mortician, maybe burying things that ought to be buried, or killing off things that ought to be killed off. Maybe he's the ambulance driver. Maybe he's trying to kill off forest lawn, even without...
I've got one.
Yeah?
Answer to that one.
Yeah?
Bearing down on my passion for forest lawn. Is he also one who is pouring sand down a rat hole?
Yeah, I don't understand that image.
Well, I got sort of a Sisyphus image He's endlessly pouring something into something that never fills up.
Yeah, I guess he is.
No worries.
But if he's really performing well, this work that he creates, you never can quite understand it, and it's always open-ended, and it's sort of tentative, and all art, you never can quite put your finger on and nail it down. If it's sort of good, it's like a joke. Once you've heard it, it's dead. But a significant painting never quite reveals itself. In itself, it is a kind of endless reservoir with layers and layers and layers of possible meaning.
This is a distinctive characteristic of the artist or of art that is open or not.
Yes.
Then again, I have to take exception to that. Sorry. All
right.
You may have creative work, say, as a physician, as a chemist, as an engineer, as a physicist. You see, you work at the frontier of science, you push it forward. There's a obviously open-ended field in which you work all your life. So this is nothing which is specifically restricted to an artist.
No, but maybe the work that the engineer does is sort of complete in itself. It becomes sort of an end in itself. But a great poem or a great painting or a great piece of music, you never can quite get a hold of it.
I thought of a much kinder word than the one I used before. The word that comes to me now is kaleidoscopic. Unlimited viewpoints, unlimited vision.
That's better than sand down a rat hole.
I thought you might like it a little better.
Did I answer you?
Yeah, that's fine.
I mean, the better mousetrap, maybe there'll be a better one another day, but for right now, this mousetrap is complete in itself, and we can understand it.
Where you hear the lecture preceding yours?
No.
Well, this, you have the expanding, exploding picture of atomic energy, for the good and for the bad. They are certainly not a mousetrap, not the lure one. It is like an explosion of some missile or something like this, the field of science. And it was mentioned in passing, the explosion in the field of medicine. That in the last 5 years, the medical profession has gained insight in things which it hadn't since the times of the Greek, you see. It is an explosion of obviously open-ended things.
Yeah.
It is not from one mousetrap to the next, no. You don't mind if I challenge you?
No, no, that's good. That's very interesting.
Perhaps the doctor is really an artist. Or the atomic scientist is the artist.
Well, I think John said earlier that he saw a lot of things as art.
Yeah.
Including, he said, preaching, and you named a number of other areas. Sorry. I was concerned that you didn't include teaching. I think that's an art.
I was concerned that you didn't include cooking.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
If you think that way, then of course it is, what you say is true.
Maybe we could just talk about the word art for a second. And we think of it as the craft, maybe the craft of teaching, or the technique of teaching, or the technique of surgery. And I don't want to de-emphasize the technique.
Does art manipulate truth? Technique.
Well, does art manipulate truth, did you ask?
I use the word technique. To me, that all means manipulation.
Yes. It's manipulating tools and materials. And last week I was trying to say that the manipulation itself has great meaning and communicates a lot. I was talking about Louis Armstrong, and he forgot his words, and so he just kept singing, and the way he sang became an expressive kind of vehicle. He was singing Doobie Doobie Doo. And I was trying to say that that in itself said a great deal. Um, But art today tends to concern itself with those techniques that provide the minimum amount of barrier, so you can go as directly as you can to what you're trying to say. And we don't, you could say that artists today aren't good craftsmen, but I think their intentions are different, and they're trying to say something different, and they don't spend the amount of time that it took the Northern Renaissance painters to create these immaculate images. Let's see, we could talk about the technique of teaching, and it's certainly the way you teach can be a marvelous tool. Just the way you perform can really communicate. And the same would be true with surgery or any kind of research. But then I guess there would also be some product, some object that's created, and that object is built out of a technique, but it becomes an expressive kind of thing that endures. Maybe it's the way you organize your living room. And that can be, that environment that you live in can be a sort of powerful, gutsy kind of environment. See, I don't quite know what it is I'm trying to say here. Where did we get started now?
I think you're doing remarkably well, considering how many times sort of redirected what you were thinking
about. I would say work for art with my GED. I think that art is able to communicate deepest insights which the world cannot communicate to you because of its finite limitations. And this pertains, among other things, to Christian doctrine. There are certain Christian doctrines which you read, which you recite, maybe even every week, and which have not gotten true Son of the Father, conceived in eternity, and true man born of the Virgin. Now, how many hands have we said that? But if you hear in the minor mark of Bach, the point where the creed, the Nicene Creed, is recited, where these words are sung, you have two voices which are contrapuntually intertwined. And when I heard that for the first time, this concept of the dual person of Christ, I wouldn't say it took meaning, but it became alive. It was illuminated from an entirely new side. So the art had communicated to me, a fairly intelligent person who can read and has read these things many times, a complete new insight and a complete new dimension. Only art.
Well, rhythm and movement and sound and color, these are powerful vehicles for expressing the idea of the spirit. You can't talk about it, as you say. I would like to have been around in about 700 A.D. Now, I went to Ravenna and stood in San Vitale, and I just wish I could really get a realistic picture of what life was like in that early Christian world. But when you're standing in there and you sing, you sound like you're in the bottom of a great big sewer pipe, and this sound just pounds through you. And when you speak, the sound bounces around behind all these columns and way up. This is a round church, and then the walls are covered with this mosaic, and nobody ever made mosaic like this before. And you really are in another world. The light sifts through these thin pieces of alabaster, and they play on this mosaic, and there's gold and red, and everything dances and moves, and I guess it's kind of a trip, or kind of euphoria. I don't know if this spread out into the whole community, but there must have been a direct kind of communication of all these ideas you were talking about in the creed, and we tend to turn them down into such rigid and narrow, boxed-in kinds of statements, and the artist wants to push out these statements and these beliefs and creeds and make them be as big as they're supposed to be. Some people can respond to the music or the color or the sound, and I would admit that there are some people who maybe never will respond that way, and they have to have the practice of the pulpit or of the sermon. But I guess I'm temperamentally suited to respond to the other elements of the liturgy other than the sermon, or other than the precise sort of definition of the term. I respond more to the performance itself, or to the technique, or just to the drama of the service, or the walking, as we walked last Saturday night, all those kinds of things, where you kind of get in there directly. Would anybody like to say anything more about this general area? Let's see, we just have a few minutes here. But I was trying to say that the artist as a revolutionary was different from the political revolutionary. And then at the same time, I also called him a mortician. And so in a sense, he's the same as the political revolutionary, except that his product goes into this reservoir. And I don't, if it's a good work of art, it never dies. It has this open-endedness, it's tentative, and it always speaks. And all is always now, to sort of quote T.S. Eliot, or there's this idea of the now. All good work of art always lives in the present. But every significant work of art all still is some kind of protest. And in the Renaissance, a man like Giotto discovered the world. Art in the medieval world was flat and abstract and two-dimensional, and we denied the earth, and Giotto rediscovered the earth, and he made a space that man could walk around in. In a sense, he is killing off the whole medieval world. And Leonardo da Vinci, with the Mona Lisa, made a body and figured out how to make the body live in the world, and in a sense, Leonardo was killing off Giotto. And that, the Mona Lisa really is a part of the landscape, and man rightfully belongs on the earth. And we could point out all the way through art history how the artist sort of rehabilitates the earth or man or some dimension of man. If you think of Rembrandt, in the 17th century, religion seems to have gotten to be very concrete and very specific and sort of very narrow. And Rembrandt celebrates, again, the invisible world, the spiritual world, the inside of man, the mystery of man, the dark places in man. And nobody had talked about these dimensions for a long time. He kills off, in a sense, some of his contemporaries, or some of the arts that went before it, that got so concrete and so realistic and so specific, kind of matter of fact.
Yes? You said that art always has an element of protest in it. Our art is always a protest, I think you said. Can it sometimes be a confirmation?
It is both. The creative act is affirming and positive, and it builds, but as it affirms something, it must deny something.
You can have a picture of, say, the war in Vietnam. It's very powerful, and you're very aware of the protest against the war, but you can also, if it's a good picture, be very aware that it's celebrating life.
Well, then we got a different definition now, that art is at the same time protest and confirmation, since they're quite opposite.
I think you speak of the present. generation of the great situation. If you think of the Renaissance, where the art was recommissioned by the church and they put out very numerous saints and virgins with child and so on, there was no protection.
The genre
they were sometimes slyly to have their mistress, their pose as the virgin, which is a story in itself, but it's their always an affirmative picture. Always an affirmative picture to uplift the
But I think Giotto, in affirming the existence of real trees and real space, was sort of protesting against the flat world of the medieval. In that wallpaper kind of thing.
Whether he protested or whether he, an open-ended artist,
Well, I think he was protesting against those too rigid hierarchical structure to his world, and he wanted to free it. He was
discovery is something new. I don't think this is implied as protection. Breakthrough is something new. If you do that, you don't protest
necessarily. Well,
again,
I'm using the word too loosely, but I would say when you bring something into being that hasn't been there before, in a way you're saying the way we looked at things before is wrong. And maybe you could say there's an element of protest in there.
You talked before about the Beatles turning out a movie, The Yellow Submarine, which I haven't seen, but which you say may change movies in future. And yet you added that they probably didn't do this, they didn't speak meaningfully in their music, in this movie, to create a new way to do things. They just wanted to create something which may in effect cause a new kind of production of movies or whatever. And so really you're saying in a sense the artist doesn't start out to do these kinds of things, is that right?
He just starts out to make the best possible movie he could make, and maybe he's bored with all the movies that have happened before. He's not concerned about the future, about making prophecy, about being novel. He just wants to do a very good piece of work.
So then, like Ludwig is saying, is he really protesting, or is he just trying to create a new technique or something, you know, that's different?
Well, he's protesting in the sense that he thinks Gone with the Wind was a great movie, but he just couldn't see himself. He'd fall asleep if he just was recreating that movie again.
I think of a Latvian artist I knew in the refugee camps. It was always, all through his refugee painting life, in the corner of the picture, and perhaps before, but at least in these years, he put a window and a spire. But it was the spire of a church in Riga, Latvia, in which he had been driven. And everybody thought this was, you know, beautiful, and this was his technique, this was his trademark, but it was also his protest that against his country being occupied and being mutilated, and he could not go back. And he always put it in there, and it felt like looked like an affirmation. But if anyone had asked him, it would have been protest, the spot. So it's maybe what you said, it's perhaps both. I think that very often I hear John saying it's a both and rather than either or world he seems to live in. I had a dogmatics professor in seminary who maintained that his great thesis was that the church must become more a both and thinking people and not an either or thinking people. That's the way I hear John.
I like the idea too. I used the word open-ended. It reminded me of the quote that love, like good poetry, dies by analysis.
Yeah.
You know, it's just so far that you can analyze any work of art, and then it's open-ended, and then it's an either-or, and then you have to figure
it out. When I hear Ludwig talk about something in a whole period of time for a century as being, you know, of a certain character, it's over against another subsequent century, and so you have your both and, your tension. I think the word open-ended has several meanings too to us, so
open-ended to some people means one thing, but perhaps it is a it's a relational word, really. It's not just a word that fizzes out. The picture of open-ended is another one of those that we maybe should explore sometime.
I wondered if, just to pursue this protest word again, when Herb has a jogging the imagination session or jogging the liturgy session, does this mean he's fed up with the liturgy? Does he just want to be different? Does he just want to be novel? Well, I don't know if you can answer that.
Yes, I think I want to affirm. I want to affirm something that's essential to the Christian life. I want to affirm it for the worship hour. I want to affirm it for any time of the day or night as an element essential to Christian living. That is, to be an introiter kind of person and to have that gift to question why, or that gift to say, as Carol would say, because. It's the same thing. One's a question, one's an F statement. And that's what I want to affirm. However, you know, in order to rediscover it, I explore in some protesting kind of ways and nudge, you know, give the Latin a little kick in the pants, because I, for 40 some years, have heard it as a kind of a Latin word, and the only explanation I've been getting is sort of a translation of the Latin, but it doesn't help me. Because the imagery that I want that word to carry isn't carried by a Latin translation. And so I protest against all the people who never said anything to me about it. And then subconsciously I'm protesting and affirming. I suppose both, yeah.
I think the trouble with the word protest is we were here last night with Paul's talk. I am curious what is it. Protest is a part of our ecology in America. I mean, we just without thinking, even though we've never mentioned the word, I'm sure you've all got in the back of your mind flashing up things.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to pull it out of our whole background and apply it here, as you're trying to apply it.
I'm thinking
affirmative sense.
I'm thinking of Protestant, which I guess was protest, maybe like today, but it's more concerned with rehabilitating. Yeah. Well, and there, I guess we shouldn't really use the word Protestant anymore, because I don't think there's a great deal of that quality except in little places here and there. It seems to be in the Catholic Church.
Another way of maybe looking at this is the word radical means to get to the root. And I think maybe if you look at it from this, rather than calling her a protester, just calling her radical. And if you think of radical as being getting to the root of something, he's trying to get to the root of something.
That's good. Then you go over
the hands. Then we could call, that's I guess what I was trying to say all morning. That the artist
plans.
The artist is trying to get.
No.
The artist is a radical who tries to get to the roots of things and lay them
and
out on the table. And
and
let's see, can we get the word beauty back in here now?
I'd say that was a beauty.
It worked.
The artist is a radical who tries to get at the root of things. And when you speak, it's an affirmation, and that's good.
What about the iron of peace when the word fails? When there's not a word for it, he uses something else.
Yes. Each media has its own unique potential for talking about something that the other one can't talk about.
You remember that definition again? The artist is a radical who cuts away the roots of things?
No.
And pour sand in the holes.
Paul wants to rehabilitate Buckskin and Copper Mountain by putting a tram up there. so we can all go up there. And he wants to cut down all those trees and put colored lights on the mountain. So we get all those dirty brown rocks can take on a better color. I think he's got some great ideas.
You have talked so much about Christ and his majesty and his love for children, love for the sick. And that's all wonderful and all fine. But I think during the new dimension, the really new dimension, is you look at your own life. You are not going to tell us. Do that, you have to learn. And you will have to.
All right, we're supposed to be open-ended, so we'll just stop in the middle of a sentence and say, well,